Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 199, Tibetan Medicine, Soa Rigpa, and Yutok the Elder.
Exactly what we're all looking for. How does the mind fix the problem? And actually, that's the basis. Gela has this other book that he hasn't been talking about, or maybe you did in the sessions I wasn't here. It's called Mirror of Light. And the Mirror of Light represents, the person of this Yutok, Gyaldin Gumbo. And this is the younger Yutok. So I wanted to give that history contextualization about that. And of course, that's all that Yutok is doing. That's what Medicine Buddha is doing, in other words. How does Buddha's vision of the total positive reality of nirvana being the actual reality of things, how can that be channeled and funneled and implemented to beings who are gripped by delusion, misknowledge, ignorance, misknowing, mistakenly knowing, how can it be channeled to become therapeutic for them? And yesterday, Tianla blew my mind by translating a mantra as psychotherapy. Yeah. I never heard that. It's really good, actually. Because it's a traditional thing. Man is like manas, the Sanskrit word manas, which means mind, mentality. And tra is like tara, it means delivering or liberating. Mm-hmm. So it means liberating the mind or protecting the mind. They can take it either way. Like tara is to protect, tara means to save or to protect, So that is psychotherapy, absolutely. So through psychotherapy, in other words, psychotherapy means, and since things are psychosomatic, then that means if your mind is enlightened, then you will be able to heal yourself. Mm-hmm. And then this morning, I had a little bit of another dream, but I had a thought came to me, but the way the day went, I didn't have time to write it. But I actually believe, and we can, I think, accurately say, I could argue, that a person's becoming a Buddha in any universe is sort of like an astrophysical event. It's like it's the opposite of a black hole. Remember, we recently had this thing where two black holes collided? Remember that? And they measured it with a laser beam that was two laser beams that were a mile or something long. Mm-hmm. The two laser beams went blip, blip, or something. And they analyzed, their whole set of theories made that the collision of two black holes, which in a way can't really collide because they should have eaten each other, Because supposedly black holes where everything gets sucked in. Right. So black hole is like a physical symbol of utter selfishness. And the center of a black hole would be hell, basically. And everything totally compressed and nothing can escape. And it's sort of a physical model of that, you could say. And a Buddha is the opposite. A Buddha is a being who completely expands and embraces everything and becomes the presence. Everything becomes the presence of a Buddha, what's called Dharmakaya of the Buddha. Dharma there meaning reality, or even nirvana it actually means, emptiness, reality, the ultimate. A body of the ultimate. So what that means is that for example, right now, everyone who ever became a Buddha, and there's supposedly infinite numbers, they feel that they are us and the building and the table and the floor and the trees and everything. But it doesn't bother them to feel that. That's why it's kind of inconceivable. They're like a giant CAT scan that never got turned off. But then they're in a state of perfect joy, feeling they are all of us. If you can think about that, empathetically feeling all of us. But their perfect joy does not blind them to our failure to feel full of joy. So it's a very strange thing. When you can expand to embrace everything, then you feel everything as if it were blissful. When you contract to get away from what you think of some bad things, then you become not unblissful, because you're guarded and armored and protected and imprisoned yourself. So therefore, when some being becomes a Buddha, it's like they have this experience of being everything, and it's not just an escaping into, you know, there are some forms of spiritual traditions that think that the high thing is to just disappear from everything, and it's all, this doesn't exist, and it's like, and even emptiness is misunderstood that way, that it's just, you know, so they don't, you know, where it's all one, and it's all me, but it isn't really me, because there's no one else, but I'm all by myself, and I don't care. But that's not Buddha, because Buddha cares. But so it's all Buddha, it's all bliss, but Buddha cares because some parts of it, the other beings, who he doesn't think they're other, actually. He experiences them as if they were themselves, from within themselves, sort of within their atoms. But they think that things are other than them. So therefore they are feeling overwhelmed by a big universe that they can't handle. So then the compassion of a Buddha makes the Buddha do something for them, you know. And then medicine Buddha does it through healing, body and mind, you know. A Buddha does it, the highest thing is through teaching, because by people coming to new understanding, then they can heal themselves, sort of idea, right? So, but I was thinking that when a being in a particular field of beings, who are not ultimately different from each other, goes through that experience, becomes that experience of being all of them, you know? So that he's like in love with all beings, that means. And what we would think of is in love, right? You're in love, you become the beloved, sort of, and it's all one, you know? And they are more important than yourself previously. So a Buddha is a being who has this kind of explosive awareness that incorporates everything. And that's like a star exploding. It's like a pulsar, it's like all this energy, channeling all this love energy in all directions, but in a very precise way, because it isn't just some sort of smashing bright light that people would then put on sunglasses or take a parasol to protect themselves from the flow of energy that they would be frightened about, because they feel separate from what's not them. Mm. And so it's all skillfully modulated to achieve, you know, to reach them in a way that can be ultimately beneficial for them. And the guarantee of the ultimate beneficiality of that energy coming from such an event as an individual becoming a Buddha is basically kind of cosmic. It's like suddenly in the field there's a subliminal emanation that the way to happiness is to give yourself to the universe in a certain way, rather than fight it off, which is we are all trying to fight it off. The universe. The misknowing person wants to fight off the universe because they think it's going to devour them, time will kill them, sickness will get them, old age, you know, death, you know. So that we want to keep away from all of that. But then when one being in that field who's all interconnected by vibes with everybody else has the opposite and goes inside out, so to speak, suddenly everybody feels there's a doorway to freedom in that somehow. Right? They automatically, subliminally though, it's like there's a place that is not just everybody confirming that everybody else should be fighting dog eat dog one against another. Somebody embraces all, and therefore when the devil, Mara, challenges Buddha at the time of his enlightenment, how dare you be a Buddha? Who asked you? Oh, you're a Buddha? Like, we don't want to hear about that type of thing, right? Mara says, you know, do. And then Buddha says, well, you got to be Mara because you did one good thing in a previous life to a fellow devil. Uh-huh. You gave him like a glass of water when he was thirsty. And by that one unselfish act, you now are the king of all the devils. You're the head devil. And I did great things in infinite past lives for infinite people. I gave my body, my eyes, my head, my blood, my family, my kingdom, my wealth. Again and again and again and again and again, lifetime after lifetime. You know, like a mother gives from her blood and her calcium or whatever else to a child. And so Buddha, and he said, then the devil said to him, try to trap him finally to that. So therefore, I now am going to be a Buddha, because that's the way of really giving to everyone. He doesn't really say it like, he just says, therefore now I can become a Buddha. Then the devil says to him, well, what's your witness? You are, with your clairvoyance, are a witness that I did a good thing and gave a glass of water to somebody, as if you had a witness for karma, for the causality of karma to work. And Buddha said, who's your witness to all those? You say you did all those things, but who? How do you prove it? Who's the witness? And that's why the Buddha touches the ground like this with his hand. He touched the Mother Earth, and Mother Earth jumps up and says, I'm the witness. I was here. He did it on Earth. And I saw him, like, when he was an elephant, he fed his body to a caravan full of starving people. When he was a rabbit, he jumped in the fire. There's all these stories, you know, the former infinite, of the infinite former lives of the Buddha. Just a few are taught. So anyway, when I woke up, Gelar, I was thinking that, therefore, when any one being becomes like that completely, it sort of opens the door of liberation to everyone else. That person becomes like the opposite of a black hole, becomes like a pulsar of encouraging energy that goes out to everyone. Because in a way, it's through the discovery that there is no place to grasp and control and dominate and own. There is no such place. So everything is given away. You know, Buddha's like, you know, Buddha is a transcendent giving. It's Buddhahood. It's the transcendence of giving. Okay? So then within that, Buddha became Medicine Buddha, and then he taught all these wonderful healing things. But it all radiates from the fact that somebody proved that the great thing is to give yourself to the universe, and did it by doing it. And we all feel, therefore, we're in this fortunate position, evolutionarily and historically, to be aware that that is possible, and that that is fully fulfilling. And that's a kind of, that's an implication, a logical implication of a discovery that reality is blissful and perfect and clear light and whatever you want to call it. Blue, it can be blue too. Blue, green, yellow, red, white. So that by giving yourself to it, then you become that. You follow me? So that fact. So then all of this comes to us. Then the great adepts of India, which was the most, it was California of the ancient world, you know, ancient Eurasia, you know. It was the most advanced place, you know, best climate, richest economy, either mineral, vegetable, fruit, 2,000 varieties of mangoes, you know, it was like jewels, you know, Maharajas giving their weight in jewels every year. It was really, that's why the British and all the foreigners got, before that, the Muslims got after it, because it was this really rich place. Compared to the desert West Asia, you know, to China with all its floods and things, and they tolerated all these amazing, wonderful people. They didn't persecute the holy people like in the more poor places, where they wouldn't want people dropping out from fighting in the wars or planting the plants or beating the women or bearing the children, and going and being monks and nuns and attaining some sort of personal evolutionary fulfillment. They didn't want that. In the poorer places, they wanted to dragoon everybody, but in India they tolerated it because they had a surplus of everything, and so there were all these great people. And then they saw those adepts. They saw history. They knew who were the Muslims. They knew people coming by boat and with weapons and things from South Asia, from West Asia, I'm sure the Enlightened Ones knew even about the Europeans with all of their violent colonialism later. But anyway, 1,000 years ago, or 1,300 years ago, they said, well, we need a place to save this treasure, because although these people, now that our people are more gentle and civilized and capable, they're going to be not able to fight off some lesser people who just want to conquer somebody and beat them up and take their stuff, you know, consume them. And so we need to keep our place. Where can we keep it? And then they looked north of India, up in the mountains, and they saw Gelas lineage, the Zamdovas and Mongolians and Tibetans, but especially those who had amazing, who were particularly amazing because they could live at this high altitude, you know, and they slowly filtered up from the lowlands around them, and they taught them, and they were not discriminating against them. Those were people. Like the Tibet was like a giant Pentagon. They conquered everybody around them when they felt like going out and looting and pillaging. They even conquered China at one time for a short time in Tang Dynasty. And they took control of the Silk Route. And they were, and the one good thing about them, as far as their neighbors were concerned, was that since they liked living at high altitude, the lack of oxygen made them high in the light. And they liked that. They never colonized. They didn't settle down in some lowland river valley. They consider that a, like a sludgy way to... Nomads in general don't like cities. They think they're kind of... In the ancient Rig Veda, in the early mandalas of the Rig Veda, the ones that nobody ever reads, they are talking about how the big cities of the Indus Valley are like anthills, and they should stamp on them. They call their god to stamp on them and scatter them so that then they can gallop their horses on them. You know, like nomads are like that. So then the Tibetans, they taught them this wonderful new vision. They felt the impact of this being who turned himself inside out and himself, herself, itself, whatever you want to call it, at that stage of a Buddha, you know, infinite loving energy. And they decided that was more fun than conquering some Chinese and Nepalis and Persians and other people and Mongolians around them. And then they became these great Dharma people. And then in the process, the medicine came up from, knowledge came up from India. They had their own shamans who were knowledgeable, but much more sophisticated stuff came out of India. Connecting, you know, this is it's an amazing thing. Bile, phlegm, and wind, you know, that they should be exactly correlative to anger, delusion, and lust. And that therefore you can deal with your psychotherapy, psychosomatic issues through the dealing with them as the three poisons of mind, or you can look at them as poisons of the body, because body, mind ultimately are interconnected. It's just a question of how to get all the cells of the body to know that they are light cells, so that they're consciously being light cells. So whatever, you know, not just the conceptual mind, you know, but you need the conceptual mind to do it, apparently. So then this wonderful thing happened where, you know, the kings, at first the kings and the nobles, they realized this was a better way to live than having to control their troops and go and conquer people and make treaties amongst themselves and fight with each other and then, you know, sort of wait in between campaigns and then to satisfy the soldiers who are uptight in order to be able to kill. They have to have new loot and they have to pillage and attack another society near them to get something. And so, you know, it's unstable. Militarism is an unstable thing. And they realized that the great cultures of India and by that time China and even Central Asia, so all around them, all the great cultures were Buddhist in the sense that they knew about this self-explosion, you know, selflessness realization that was spreading, that spread from the Buddha's realization. And they knew about it. And so they brought it into their people. And then some of them fought it. And after a couple hundred years, there was a big reaction against it. And they said, we're going back to our more military thing. But by that time, the people decided they preferred not being troops, not living like that, being more happy and friendly, being nicer to their wives, whatever, girlfriends. And so even though there was a like an 80-year, 100-year period where their Buddhism was sort of put into stagnation, except for some private people, still, it came back because the people by then wanted it after the collapse of the empire, you know, because it collapsed because it couldn't control by violence, which is how empires are controlled. When it started, when from the top dominators, they started spreading the Dharma, then they sort of, boom, when they worked themselves out of a job, because then people decided they didn't want to be dominated and they didn't want to be sent off on a campaign to China or something to get some loot, you know, they'd rather live happily and eat rocks and drink chan and eat zampa, you know, like the Tibetans do. And unfortunately eat the occasional yak, like nomads do, you know. The Yutok, elder Yutok was transmitted, when you said it here, it was transmitted directly from Manjushri or something, and then he says...
And Yutok's song, I think.
Look. Right in the beginning somewhere. But anyway, so that the senior Yutok, so then King Chisong Dedzen, who was an emperor of the empire in China in the late 8th, early 9th century, he decided that this medicine was a super huge thing, and it was very important to his civilization. So he organized a big conference that lasted for 40 years, 45 years, in the first monastery that was built in Tibet called Sanye Monastery. And then he called doctors from the royal courts of all the neighbors who were scared of him because they were big fighters, the Tibetans, and had the knowledgeable physicians sent from India, from Nepal, from Bengal. Those were different countries at that time. India wasn't one country. From Bengal, from Kashmir, from Nepal, from China, and he had these people sent, and then they sat and compared notes on the framework of the Buddhist medicine idea coming from original Buddha, because Buddha's, the Four Noble Truths are like a medical diagnosis. So he initially was a doctor rather than a prophet or something, or, I'm going to save you. It wasn't at all. It's like a good doctor doesn't pretend they save you. They realize they just help you bring your own health out.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part podcast was originally recorded in 2016 at the Tibet House US program Tibetan Secrets of Longevity, held at Menlo Retreat and Dewa Spa in Phoenicia, New York. To learn more about annual programs with Professor Thurman and Dr. Nita at Menlo Retreat, please visit menla.us. The first half of this week's episode, Professor Thurman gave us an introduction to the history of Buddhist medicine and Soa Rigpa, or the Tibetan science of healing, as it's been passed down through Tibet and India and in the teachings of Dr. Nita. Professor Thurman continues this discussion in the second half with biographies of the two Utahs and a great guided meditation on selflessness. If you're inspired to learn more about Tibetan medicine, be sure to check out past episodes of the Bob Thurman Podcast that are tagged Buddhist Medicine or Medicine Buddha. There's several from Professor Thurman's teachings at the Force for Good class series and more from Professor Thurman and Dr. Nita's retreats at Menlo Retreat in Dewa Spa. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part by the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. Membership benefits include special invites to tours around the world with Professor Thurman, the Geographic Expedition, discounts on events in New York City, and at programs at Menlo Retreat and Dewa Spa. If becoming a monthly supporter isn't an option for you, please be sure to comment, like, subscribe, and share the Bob Thurman Podcast on all your favorite social media platforms. Your online participation helps support Professor Thurman's mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture in the West through Tibet House US and Menla Retreat. And as always, music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is provided by Tenzin Chogyal, used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzin Chogyal, visit his website at tenzinchogyal.com. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode and a reading of the poetry of Allen Ginsberg by Gary Gock.
Ningtek was first taught, and the Ningtek, of course, the heart drop, which is what this is. This is advanced stuff. You found it, thank you. It says, was first taught in the pure land of Tanaduk by the medicine Buddha. So it's from Buddha. That's a way of saying it's from Buddha, in his medicine Buddha form. Then, again, in Udayana, which was something like Afghanistan, actually, on earth, where Padmasambhava came from, the founder of Buddhism, the adept founder of Buddhism in Tibet, in the 8th century. And that's where Yutok the older Yutok, went and got that teaching again from Padmasambhava in Udayana. And then finally it was taught to Yutok, it was this paragraph, thank you, Gama. It was taught to Yutok Yonten Gombo the Younger, which is this gentleman here, this Buddha there, by the wisdom Dakini. We had a Dakini guru, like Yella did, right? Did you tell him about your guru, the nun, famous nun?
Not yet,
okay. Wisdom Dakini Pelden Tama, to which it became known as the profound, pure vision Dharma cycle it is today, although I would call that Dharma collection or Dharma teaching. And so from this we can see that maintaining the welfare of sick beings, this is in regard to your question, as one's primary aim is the sign of extensive and authentic spirit of enlightenment, bodhicitta, you know, the enlightenment soul, and is the achievement, the selflessness gene, let's say, which is something that you find in yourself and then you're there for all beings. It's like the seed of that Buddhahood experience of where you become all the beings, you know, in a loving way, if you follow me. So Westerners can't, it's a spirit of enlightenment is how I translate people, Bodhi mind, people say things like that. And is the achievement of mastery as a bodhisattva. From this profound path, Yutok the elder achieved in his lifetime the state of an awareness holder or a vidyada. And vidya means awareness holder in one way, but one way vidya also means science. The five sciences are called the Pancha Vidya. So it means not science means knowledge, you know. So Vidyadhara means a scientist, actually. I had a friend, a translator, a young Tibetan guy. And the Vidyadharas are usually depicted in art. They're in the Book of the Dead paintings, for example, and they're like yogis. They look like sadhus with long hair. They have maybe a bone ornament in the hair and have like a little loincloth and it looks like that. And the one translator said, no, you can't say Vidyadhara is a scientist. Scientists wear white coats and they have a little white thing on top of their head, you know, that they look like. And the Vidyadharas are like naked adepts, nearly naked, like sadhus, actually. Those are the real scientists, you know, actually. So he lived in the state of Vidyadhara, and he lived until the age of 125. I like that. And then along with his consort and all of his holdings, achieved the great transference of the rainbow body, you know, transference, I like to translate as soul ejection, you know, like an ejection seat in a jet airplane, and you're a jet pilot and you're crashing, you press a button and your seat goes like, and then the parachute opens. So the poa means, they call it, people do translate transference, but I'd say great ejection, you know, so they shoot out of the ordinary by the rainbow body. And then in the 12th century, in front of many attendants, Yutok the Younger passed into the rainbow body of the Great Transference without any obstacles as well. So there can be no doubt at all of the great significance of the guru lineage of the Yutok Ningtek, the heart drop of Yutok. And then there's this like hippie looking guy, and it's a picture. It's a good picture of Gemma. How old were you then, Gemma? 20 something?
23.
That was the summer of love. Down San Francisco. Nobody was in Tibet. Look at the hair, I love that. And you're stirring the elixir of immortality.
Yes.
And look at that. I'm sorry, but I love that picture.
Then I become younger.
What?
In this picture, I look older, right?
No, you don't look older. No, you look really amazed. I think you're beginning your, you're in the earlier part of your world mission to live up to the spirit of Yutok. You know, then Yutok, you know, Yutok became a Buddha, I think. See, the great thing also is, it isn't also, although it's a astrophysical event, someone becoming a Buddha, like the opposite of a black hole, a pulsar, you know, on a planet, and then everybody gets a little, maybe I can get liberated, you know. Otherwise, why would, you know, people don't think they're going to be liberated. Like, you have a tigress or something, or a lioness on the African, you know, veldt, you know, that's there. And she's there, and then, you know, the lazy male lion doesn't do any hunting, and the cubs are here. She has to swat him away not to mess with the cubs. And then she has to run out and chase antelopes and drag them back. And within that sort of instinct-driven survival, subsistence livelihood of that tigress, where is she going to have an idea, oh, I can get liberated from this tiger-eat-antelope evolutionary life niche. There's some way of getting more free than that. And maybe they see a little bushman running along, a Maasai warrior or something, and they see the Maasai warrior is maybe riding a horse, or I don't know what they do, or driving a jeep nowadays. They say, oh, that guy, he can do more things, you know. I don't have the pause to drive a jeep. Maybe I would be better off like that. Although I wouldn't be able to run and catch an antelope the same way, but oh, they have guns, they shoot them. Oh, hey, maybe I'm good. But how would a tigress think that? In other words, you know, the tigress, I think, she just had her litter. She fought off the male guy. The other tigress has maybe brought her some stew for lunch for a while until she's back on her feet a few days. And then she's charging to get the next meal for the brood and for the and whatever. And then as she's going after this herd of antelope, there's a pregnant one, pregnant antelope, who is going slower than the other antelopes. And then there's a horrible old stringy looking one with a broken horn and who's faster though, and some other ones. And she could easily get that pregnant one. But somehow, subliminally, she feels empathetically, because she was just carrying like four or five little cubs in her belly for some period of time. And she senses that this animal is doing that. Contrary to the main thing, that the main concept of a tiger is that's food. It's just food on the hoof. And then so there's some life there. And so swerves away from the easier victim and grabs the stringy old crappy one, skinny old one. But he just has some bones to crunch up and a little meat. Doesn't go after that juicy pregnant one. And then that would be that tiny little increment of like identifying with another in front of you then leads to humanity from Buddhist evolutionary description. Buddha's Darwin. That's what it is. It makes you a little, but it's very hard for an animal. If you really think about that, if you understand it as a scientific explanation of evolution, of the individual, then you will realize you will value yourself as a human being much more. Because you will realize that you, although you can't remember it, you were an animal like that, and you had those kind of little tiny impulses in the midst of your basic get that food for the tribe there, you know, for the pack or for whatever you call it, you know, and eat that thing, and it's just your food, it's not another being. And yet you somehow identified with the other being, the alien being. And then that made you expand your awareness of the world and see it from that other perspective at that so tiny increment that an animal can do. And that's how you work your way up to being a human from a Buddhist point of view. Therefore, they say that the karmic evolutionary root of humanity is ethics. So fascinating. Shila, the second of the transcendences. The human being got to be human by being ethical among animals. Because ethical means, doesn't mean following rules that someone told the tigress not to chase the pregnant one, because some later anthropologist said, oh, that's just doing that because the tigress knows there'll be two deer to eat later. That's what they say in biogrammarians, what they call, you know, the materialists say things like that. That's ridiculous. It's a empathy on part of the mother tiger, you know, that she has. And so if you do that, then you will appreciate yourself. And you'll realize why they say that the human being will not, thank you for taking the mic, the human being that you have, the platform, the evolutionary platform of the human embodiment that you have is incredibly precious and very difficult to create. And it is created by your own evolutionary effort and your own development of ethics into where you become a being that has the ability to identify with many other beings, actually. We all know we identify with the beloved when we're in love, and with the child when we are parenting, and so on. And we all know that we can do that. But of course, and we also know in the case of more extraordinary beings in extraordinary circumstances, that they can identify with a lot of beings, right? And then Buddhahood is just identifying with all beings. Yes, what's the question?
You piqued our curiosity about Dr. Nita.
I'm sorry?
I said you've piqued our curiosity about Dr. Nita.
Yes, about his biography.
Yeah, because we can read a little bit about Yutuk in the books.
I know, but we can't really tell that.
We can't read anything about Dr. Nita and his experience with the Dakini and that sort of thing.
Because, Dr. Nita is saying that thereby that it's not about him. It's about his healing work, But yes, it will be inspiring too. But I'm still back in his predecessors, whether his previous incarnation or his previous teacher. So I'm still trying to get into that. Because why it's so alien to us, the idea. We're materialists. If somebody levitated, we'd all go nuts. We'd have them arrested, like E.T. the movie. E.T. is able to do things like his little finger turns into a light bulb, and he's in the closet there and all that. And all they want to do is dissect him, and he has to escape on a levitating bicycle. So we have that in movies and things and in dreams, but we don't believe in it. We're our consensual reality. Even if logically, I have reached after 50 years of study, I have reached a place, or maybe many previous lifetimes too, but I reached a place where, to me, I can't exclude the possibility of what people would think were miracles. Mm-hmm. Logically, I think it's really prejudiced and dogmatic to think that people cannot do things that we don't imagine. There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt up in your philosophy. Even Shakespeare said so, right?
Yeah.
But still, if I saw somebody levitate, I'd be like Carlos Castaneda in that book, and I might have a freak out about my reality is collapsing, Because it would just be so against the laws of what is our consensual reality, which we reinforce in each other in this materialistic culture and even world now that we're in. So to be, the third noble truth, the Buddha says, realize it. But realizing it, each noble truth, he says, the first one, the truth of suffering, he says, acknowledge it. The second one, the truth of the origin of suffering, he says, analyze it and investigate it and understand it. And then the third one, he says, realize it. But realizing the first way of realizing nirvana or Buddhahood or any kind of, or that there is such a thing as a Buddha, as a state, an evolutionary state that a living being can reach, in fact, all living beings will reach, given the infinity of time, then it's difficult. The first way of realizing it is to try to imagine it. And it's very difficult to imagine, right? And therefore, finding out about Genla, for example, would be finding out about someone who took these teachings really seriously as a life and death matter at a young age. And he went out, and over here, I would say he's been eating rocks for a few weeks in this picture. they have this Julian retreat, these fasting retreats, where they take a mineral or a certain herb or
calcite.
Something. What?
Calcite.
No.
Calcite. Zhongxi.
Calcite. Yeah. That's like a mineral, right? Calcite.
Yes. Yes.
And they don't eat any other thing. Very little water, right? Almost no water. And then they have visions and whatever. And then they're stirring it over here. I love it. So the point is, he took it really seriously, and he luckily started young, and he developed in this direction. And only Buddha would know how much he developed. We can't say it. But it's interesting to know about his life. It's inspiring. So yeah, I'm coming to that. But I'm still back with the Yutuk the Younger. So then Yutuk the Younger taught this amazing set of things, all in this book, which I think was collected by Genla's company, right?
The Institute.
Nagman, right? the shaman, the Ngatpas, you know, the mantrikas in Amdo, they collected this and they these different things in there, and which Gela read from when he did both. So the first one we did was a U-talk initiation, and the second one was a long life. Yes. The U-talk one was for the Nyingtig itself, or just a partial? It was in a way the seed of the, it wasn't extensive, it was the brief. So in other words, you were all introduced to the advanced teaching of this, but you know, the great thing about those advanced teachings is they're really, really advanced. And you know, now that you receive them, you're so lucky and blah, blah, blah. The lamas always say, then they say, oh yeah, now there's a few preliminaries. Like how about 100,000 prostrations? Have you ever tried that? You know, so they get up to a couple thousand a day. That's all the way full. It's like a push-up. It's like a downward dog, push-up, flat on the floor, forehead touching, two hands touching over here, feet, knees, belly, then stand up again, and do a thousand, to think of doing 1,000 of them in a row. And they can do something 2,000-3,000 a day, I think, right? And then they do 100,000. That's one of the preliminaries. Then 100,000 offering of these mandals, you know. Then 100,000 guru yogas of visualizing, you know, visualizing the teacher in a certain type of visualization. Then 100, and there's a lot of other things that often they have. You know. If you know the life of Milarepa, he had to build three towers. And then the fourth one he left, four towers actually, and the first three were demolished by his teacher after he built them. Oh. And he had to put, and not only demolish them, just knock down, he had to take the rocks of building like a 9-story tower three times. And then he had to take each rock and put it back where he got it from, and had to go do it again, all in different shapes. Those were the four chakras, I think, basically. Those were, each tower had the shape of the central core of, you know, the triangle, circle, square, and oval of the different towers, you know. So there are all these preliminaries, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's great to do preliminaries in the context of something really magnificent that you're preliminarying to, rather than just doing them. Okay, so then he did that, and then that remained in the heart of Tibetan medicine since then, although his successors, you know, these people keep coming back, you know, because life and death, you know, he went in Rainbow Valley, but that doesn't mean he doesn't come back. Rainbow body is a nice goal and a target, but then rainbow Buddhas all have rainbow bodies, and they keep coming back to help other beings. You know, because once you identify with all beings, then you cannot leave anybody unhelped who needs help. It's impossible, because you are them in their need for help at the same time as you are the source of help. You see, and once you're in that kind of situation with another, then it's like automatic, like my hand. It got burned or something, or it has some pain in it, and I have to fix that pain because it's part of it, you know. Although it's my hand, you know, I could chop it off and forget about it, but I've got to fix it. So other beings become like limbs. Shantideva says all beings become like limbs of a single life, which doesn't mean that they're all the same in some categorical manner. It means they're actually the same the way they are. Which is quite the way they end, not only the way they really are, but the way they think they are, both. Both how they really are, which is fine, and what they think they are, which is miserable. And dissatisfied, and incomplete, and like looking for something. Looking for something in all the wrong places. Anyway. So there we go. And then Gela gave us that, and I've never heard anyone do it the way you did, Gela. And I really appreciate it, where you talked about the different chakras, you know, and then there's these different five wisdoms, as they're called. But I don't know if wisdom is exactly the right word. You know, the word, it's very interesting. The word for wisdom, you know, when you have the wisdom, which is the opposite of ignorance, which is the wisdom of selflessness, you know, primarily, or wisdom of emptiness. And that means a knowledge that you have by being one with what you're knowing. So it's an experiential, non-conceptual knowledge, though it is pointed to, its direction is indicated by conception, and a conception of negation. In other words, selflessness is a negation, right? No, lack of a self, it means selflessness. And so selflessness means that you are actually, why don't we all meditate that for, can we do that? I like them to meditate. Can everyone meditate? I like them to meditate on something. Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. Cross your ankles, right? Genla has been telling you how to meditate for sure. Okay, go into meditative mode, okay? And that just means breathe, concentrate, okay? And ideally, eyes half open and looking past the tip of, right at the tip of your nose or a little past it. So you have a half-lidded eyes. So you're not mainly identifying with what you're seeing. You're withdrawing into your more inner mind process, and you may have to hear thoughts in your inner mind process, which is fine. Okay? And this is a kind of vipassana type of meditating, an analytic seeing type of meditating. That the foundation of Buddha's teaching, and Yutaka Yonten Gopo's teaching, and Genla's teaching, is, Nagarjuna's teaching, is selflessness. And what that means is that it doesn't mean we don't exist, but it means that we don't exist as some sort of absolute self. Something that is real, the real fixed identity, independent from any other circumstance. That's the fixed identity that is the real us. That's what that means. But in order to really understand what it means to realize selflessness, we have to have an idea of, well, what could be the meaning of this sort of fixed identity. Well, who's talking about a fixed identity anyway? Maybe I have trouble remembering who I am. So what is this? We might think. So the first step in this meditation is to try to remember a time when you were deeply offended. Someone accused you of something you didn't do, and you wouldn't do, actually. Some mistaken thing. And for some reason, you're accused. Try to remember a time when you felt offended. And try to remember it before you got indignant and then angry. You know, you might, Gela the other day was talking a lot about anger, which I was very pleased. I would need to hear more about it. And, you know, there's a sequence. First, something offends you. Then you feel indignant that you were offended. And then when this offense, protest, indignation is not attended to by whatever offended you, you then become angry. Right? And so you know that sequence. It's all right, you're meditating, but you're thinking along with what I'm saying. And so you just think, try to remember a time when you felt offended, like what it was like, and how a feeling from within of, I should not have that happen, I did not do that, I, you know, this is unacceptable to me, a kind of, you know, like a reaction from the gut happens, then you will remember. And of course it takes working, and you have to work on that. Try to remember that time. And when you do, you might have an inkling that this chain reaction of emotions, of notions and emotions, coming from that experience of offense, of being accused unjustly, seems to arise from a place that is unquestionable, that's the solid you. It's like the real me, that's where the real me draws the line. The real me would never do that. The real me is innocent, the real, etc. It's righteous, etc. All the kind of thing. So it feels like, you know, a swooshing energy that will end in fury. And we must have all had that sequence. Seems to come from the really real place within us. It's not just sort of like a flow of water coming from we know not where. It comes from a real place inside. So the beginning of this meditation on selflessness is this first focus on the inkling of being an absolute, fixed, independent identity holding self, identifiable, objective self. So you will discover, if you pursue this meditation at length, which we don't have time to do in this setting, you will discover that you don't, at a visceral level, you don't agree with Buddha.
Reading a poem by Allen Ginsberg, written in 1955. Sunflower Sutra. I walked on the banks of the Tin Can Banana Dock and sat down under the huge shade of a Southern Pacific locomotive to look at the sunset over the Boxhouse Hills and cry. Jack Kerouac sat beside me on a busted, rusted iron pole companion. We thought the same thoughts of the soul, bleak and blue and sad-eyed, surrounded by the gnarled steel roots of trees of machinery. The oily water on the river mirrored the red sky. Sun sank on top of final Frisco peaks. No fish in that stream, no hermit on those mounts, just ourselves, roomy-eyed and hungover, like old bums on the riverbank, tired and wily. "Look at the sunflower," he said. There was a dead gray shadow against the sky, big as a man, sitting dry on top of a pile of ancient sawdust. I rushed up enchanted. It was my first sunflower, memories of Blake, my visions, Harlem, and hells of eastern rivers, bridges clanking, Joe's greasy sandwiches, dead baby carriages, black treadless tires forgotten and unretreaded, the poem of the riverbank, condoms and pots, steel knives, nothing stainless, only the dank muck and the razor-sharp artifacts passing into the past, and the gray sunflower poised against the sunset, crackly bleak and dusty with the smut and smog and smoke of olden locomotives in its eye, corolla of bleary spikes pushed down and broken like a battered crown, seeds fallen out of its face, soon-to-be toothless mouth of sunny air, sun rays obliterated on its hairy head like a dried wire spiderweb, leaves stuck out like arms out of the stem, gestures from the sawdust root, broke pieces of plaster fallen out of the black twigs, a dead fly in its ear, unholy, battered old thing you were, my sunflower, oh my soul, I loved you then. The grime was no man's grime but death and human locomotives. All that dress of dust, that veil of darkened railroad skin, that smog of cheek, that eyelid of black misery, that sooty hand or phallus or protuberance of artificial, worse than dirt, industrial, modern, all that civilization spotting your crazy golden crown, and those blear thoughts of death and dusty loveless eyes and ends and withered roots below in the home pile of sand and sawdust, rubber dollar bills, skin of machinery, the guts and innards of the weeping, coughing car, the empty, lonely tin cans with their rusty tongues, alack, what more could I name? The smoked ashes of some cock cigar, the cunts of wheelbarrows and the milky breasts of cars, worn out asses out of chairs and sphincters of dynamos. All these entangled in your mummied roots, and you there standing before me in the sunset, all your glory in your form. A perfect beauty of a sunflower, a perfect, excellent, lovely sunflower existence, a sweet natural eye to the new hip moon, woke up alive and excited, grasping in the sunset shadow, sunrise, golden monthly breeze. How many flies buzzed round you, innocent of your grime, while you curse the heavens of the railroad and your flower soul? Poor dead flower, when did you forget you were a flower? When did you look at your skin and decide you were an impotent, dirty old locomotive, the ghost of a locomotive, the specter and shade of a once powerful, mad American locomotive? You were never no locomotive, sunflower. You were a sunflower. And you, locomotive, you are a locomotive, forget me not. So I grabbed up the skeleton-thick sunflower and stuck it at my side like a scepter and deliver my sermon to my soul and Jack's soul, too, and anyone who'll listen. We're not our skin of grime. We're not dread, bleak, dusty, imageless locomotives. We're golden sunflowers inside, blessed by our own seed and hairy, naked accomplishment bodies growing into mad, black, formal sunflowers in the sunset, spied on by our own eyes under the shadow of the mad locomotive, riverbank, sunset, Frisco, hilly, tin can, evening, sit down, vision. I'm Gary Gock, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.